From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The international community will meet at the UN this Friday to finalize 17 new goals framing the world's development agenda for the next 15 years. But, according to the Director General of the UN Cultural Agency, UNESCO, if they are going to succeed, ownership of those goals by national governments is crucial. Stephanie Kutrix reports.
The 17 new targets, known as the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, will be formally adopted by the UN at a three-day summit of world leaders beginning on Friday. They'll replace the Millennium Development Goals, the deadline for which is the end of the year. Speaking at an international conference on sustainable development held at Columbia University in New York, UNESCO's Irina Bokova said national ownership was central to the success of the SDGs.
The 17 goals are truly transformative and universal. They are, I think, what is most important, owned by governments. And ownership is a key word when we speak about finding the right solutions and implementation. We have to empower governments. We have to give them the right tools.
The new goals are expected to cost billions of dollars to implement. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
The permanent representative of the United States to the United Nations, Samantha Power, warned Russia that continued use of its UN veto will jeopardize the Security Council's long-term legitimacy and could lead the U.S. and like-minded countries to bypass the Council as a decision-making body. Under the UN Charter, no country may use military force against another except in a strict case of self-defense without the approval of the Security Council. The UN Charter, which was adopted by the U.S. in 1945, is, under the U.S. Constitution, the highest law of the land. Power's warning comes as the 70th UN General Assembly is underway, and Russia's President Vladimir Putin is set to address the assembled heads of state later this week. RT's senior political correspondent, Anissa Nawi, gave a preview of that in her exclusive interview with Russia's ambassador to the UN, Vitaly Churkin.
70 years since the UN. The world, of course, has changed immensely during that time. Does the UN need to change more to adapt to the changing world?
You know, actually, I think the United Nations is constantly in the process of adapting to the new challenges. And now the big events in New York, of course, start with the Millennium Development Sustainable Development Summit, which is going to adopt the socio-economic program for the world for the next 15 years. And 15 years ago, there was another program which was successfully implemented in a number of areas. Not entirely, but that did help to tackle some of the health issues, some of the poverty issues, some of the education issues. And this work is going to continue. And speaking about adaptation, I'll give you one example. For instance, just a few months ago, there was this Ebola epidemic in Western Africa. And the United Nations led the international effort to tackle this epidemic, did it rather successfully. But at the same time, some shortcomings were revealed in the ability of the international community to respond to such challenges. So now a high-level panel established by the UN Secretary General is looking into it, and in a couple of months we'll have recommendations which will help adjust the international system to respond to such emergencies. So this is just one example.
What about the political side, the really political side? I mean, there's so much violence going on in the world, so many wars going on, not to say that poverty and health is not a tremendous and very important issue. You, of course, are a main face at the UN Security Council. Russia obviously is a big part of that. What about the difficulties that Russia is facing at the UN Security Council?
It's not just Russia, it's the international community who is facing those challenges. But at the same time, the Security Council is running close to 20 peacekeeping operations. We're running numerous special political missions which are helping to prevent conflicts in various situations. And it cannot be said that there are no successes. We're hopeful, for example, that an extremely difficult situation situation in South Sudan has been taken under control, and so we're moving in that direction in large measure because of the presence of UN peacekeepers there. So unfortunately, the past few years have witnessed a lot of new instability and new crisis, like the rise of ISIL, kind of a new level of the threat of terrorism, and we're not yet up to it as an international community. And that is not to say that the Security Council is not doing anything about it. Over the past 10 years, we have produced a lot of important documents which help deter the terrorist threat and help the international community to address the terrorist threat. For instance, a resolution whose 10th anniversary was celebrated this month under the Russian presidency in the Security Council against the spread of extremist ideology. That work was already started 10 years ago. Then recently we produced a resolution which is banning trade in oil and other things with terrorist organizations in Iraq and Syria. So there is a large effort which is underway. In some cases it is a successful effort, but apparently with a new situation, new steps to elevate that joint effort are required. And here I think is where President Putin's initiative to create a truly international coalition to fight ISIL in Syria and Iraq is very relevant.
An international coalition makes me think of a phrase that we often hear lately in the headlines on global platforms, and that is that Russia is isolated. This is something you hear from a lot of your partners at the UN Security Council, in other organizations around the world. Russia and its partners obviously aren't always on the same page. Is this beginning to be a notion that's difficult to deal with on the diplomatic front?
You know, sometimes I laugh when I hear that, because sometimes I wish we were isolated. That would make it possible for us to sit back and relax. But in fact, we find ourselves in the midst of everything and trying to find solutions to all those problems. Sometimes we fail politically because, I mean, in Syria, there was a clash between two different views of what the Security Council is supposed to do and what it is not supposed to do. Our Western partners believe that the Security Council needs to be involved in regime change operations. We believe that this is not the charter responsibility of the Security Council, which is looking after international peace and security. And moreover, we feared that this kind of policy would lead to great instability, which we saw in the case of Libya. So no, there is no Russian isolation. There is great involvement of Russia in trying to tackle all those crisis situations and difficult problems. And I feel very comfortable that Russia is making a worthy contribution to this work in the Security Council and the United Nations. Let me just give you one figure. Last year, 2014, the Security Council adopted 63 resolutions, most of them unanimously. The Security Council issued over 120 statements of various kinds, and all of them are adopted unanimously by the Security Council. So the Security Council is a great platform to build a consensus. Sometimes it doesn't happen, but the effort is there. And also the General Assembly is a great platform to build consensus. Most of resolutions of the General Assembly are adopted by consensus. This is one of the important features, important roles of the United Nations, with all differences of views. And you know, the moment you walk into the building of the United Nations, you see all those different perspectives rushing in your direction. You can really feel why and how people think differently about different situations. But you try to build a consensus. Without that, the world would have been a much more chaotic place than it actually is.
Maybe this consensus, this idea of consensus, doesn't make it to the outside world, right? The journalists, the people watching, specifically your exchanges, let's say, with partners from the United States, the UN Security Council. So a lot of the really tense issues, let's say Syria, Ukraine, MH17, some of the exchanges that we see, this is what we remember.
You're absolutely right, but this is a problem because media focuses on controversies. When everything is fine and good, what is there to report? After 3 months of hard and highly professional work, for instance, with the United States, we produced just a few days ago a very important resolution, which we hope is going to deter the use of chemicals as weapons in Syria, and hopefully then also spread its operation of this mechanism we created to Iraq. This is a very important achievement. On Syria, with all the controversy, the Security Council has produced 10 documents of various types. For instance, in August we produced a presidential statement, an official document by the Security Council in support of the activities of Staffan de Mistura, the special representative of the Secretary General. All those things are not negligible. They are important contributions of the Security Council to the work we are doing. On the humanitarian aspect of the situation of Syria, we were able to produce some groundbreaking resolutions. For instance, last year a resolution which would allow the humanitarians, UN humanitarians, to bring their supplies into Syria basically without the consent of the Syrian government, because certain overpasses were not controlled by the Syrian government. And so we were able to produce a text which balanced the urgent needs of humanitarians with the respect of the sovereignty of Syria and the Syrian government. So sometimes I think we've been very creative. We have worked very closely with our American colleagues, and the results are there.
We're talking a lot about Syria, and it's back in the headlines recently. I take your comments about the media with a grain of salt, but of course our audience will certainly be wondering what will be the arguments at the UN Security Council with accusations of, once again, they call it Russian aggression in Syria, helping the Assad regime.
In fact, they don't. I've never heard anybody call it Russian aggression.
The media certainly does.
Or in fact, speaking about, like in terms of accusations. I mean, there is nothing to accuse us of, because we're acting with the agreement of the Syrian government, and clearly there are some Russian military who are helping the Syrian army, Syrian military use the weapons we have been supplying to them. I mean, there is no secret about that. Because so there is no ground for any kind of accusation. Yes, there are concerns about how it's going to play out. Clearly, it has introduced a new element in the whole situation. Let's hope that this is going to be an element which will help bring about greater international cooperation and more effective effort to fight ISIL in Syria and Iraq. Let's face it, the American coalition has been there for a year. They have been bombing for a year. They have delivered close to 7,000 strikes, according to media reports. And the ISIL is still there. They took Palmyra, this medieval UNESCO-protected site, just a few weeks ago. So this is not an effective effort. So some new form of international cooperation, more effective methods must be found. And I happen to believe that President Putin's initiative shows some possibilities in this regard. And I hope it's going to be seriously discussed in the course of the General Assembly and later on, and something would be brought about that would give us hope that the ISIL problem would be dealt with effectively.
You are constantly bringing up the word cooperation, consensus. Do you think that it's an exaggeration that Russia and U.S. ties are at their worst since the Cold War?
Well, probably they are. This is a very tense period in our relations, but I hope it can be overcome. You know, this is what I've been doing all my life. So, by instinct, professionally, I hope for better relations with the United States and other countries. And I like to think that by working together with the United States in the Security Council and in the United Nations, sometimes we do disagree, but we do work together a lot. And sometimes, as I said, we're able to reach good results. Maybe we can contribute in our small way to the general improvement of our relations.
What do you think was a major factor in getting to this point in relations?
Well, this is a little bit outside of my field, but generally speaking, the issues of European security turned out not to be settled definitively, and there were different views about European security. The one which was sort of pursued by our Western colleagues, that of gradual expansion of sort of Western influence into Eastern Europe, and we were in favor of equal cooperation, where we could really build the Europe which was promised as Cold War ended. You may recall there was the slogan in 1990, Europe from Vancouver to Vladivostok. Then a new slogan came up, from Lisbon to Vladivostok. We are in favor of United Europe, and we believe that simply taking up Eastern Europe piece by piece, be it by expanding NATO or by arranging some new formulas of cooperation between the European Union and some Eastern European countries, disregarding the interests of Russia and those countries in Eastern Europe who are not part of those problems, was a policy which brought about tensions and which ultimately produced the crisis in Ukraine, which is very deplorable.
Do you feel that sometimes it's difficult, or how do you feel, I should say, it is in terms of convincing your partners at the UN, at the Security Council, about European security, about Russia's perspective?
Well, we do not discuss much, you know, problems of, you know, European security or global security. Our work is much more pragmatic. Of course, in the context of the crisis in Ukraine, when we had, I think, over 30 Security Council meetings, those matters were coming up. But our work is much more pragmatic than sort of philosophical. We would leave it for presidents and foreign ministers to discuss those, you know, global philosophical issues, and as they do from time to time.
You brought up pragmatism, so I want to bring up China, because they have seemed to find this niche with the United States where pragmatism wins. So it's not the best of relations, but they're based very much on the economy. Should Russia use this as an example, perhaps?
I think you're right that our Chinese colleagues are conducting a very pragmatic policy. I think Russian policy is pragmatic as well. And, you know, we are weighing our political interests against our economic interests. Sometimes economic interests have to suffer when fundamental problems emerge in our political relationship with the West, for example. But I think in terms of world philosophy, we are very close to China. China is definitely our closest partner in the Security Council and the United Nations. So I think that we proceed from the same political philosophy, which makes the China-Russia joint work in the United Nations extremely important.
But you're not necessarily perceived as the same type of power, the same type of
government. We are not the same type of power. Russia is a Eurasian country with its own traditions, with its own relationship with Europe, its own sort of track record of relations with the United States. China has is a slightly different geographical and geopolitical position. So of course, I suppose there can be some nuances, and there is a certain division of labor even in the Security Council. For example, on Syria, it's open secret that we take the lead on those matters because we are deeper involved, just generally on the Middle East. Whereas if it were to come, for instance, to the situation on the Korean Peninsula, then we would take back seat and would sort of follow the lead of our Chinese partners, and everybody knows that. So I find myself in a very comfortable cooperation with my Chinese colleagues in the United Nations.
The UN often, in recent years, probably mostly after Libya, has become sort of under the spotlight with people asking what major role can the UN play in the world? Obviously, dealing with poverty and other crises around the world is very important. But if we speak specifically about conflicts, about intervention, how powerful is it in that role? The Iraq War went on, Yugoslavia went on without the UN, Libya didn't get a veto from Russia, and we see what happened there. How effective is the UN in stopping war, stopping American policy and intervention?
Well, the UN can only do what it can do. And the United Nations is composed of its member states, and the member states have their own interests. And more importantly, I would say, there are certain limitations of political will. For instance, in some cases, greater involvement of the international community would be welcomed by everybody. But simply there is no political will. Just for example, maybe in South Sudan, we need 200,000 UN peacekeepers. And maybe we all would be prepared to subscribe to that kind of a resolution of the Security Council. But there are no volunteers to provide those 200,000 peacekeepers. No resources which the UN would want to pay to do that. And then sometimes you have to also be very careful, because sometimes, as we saw in Libya, intervention can produce unexpected results. That intervention was carried out, you will recall, with at least declared good intentions of our Western colleagues to protect civilians. Instead, they produced this chaos. And now we're working very persistently. There is a special representative of the Secretary General. He's negotiating with various parties. But is greater intervention in Libya possible? We believe not, because it may produce even greater chaos, to say nothing of the fact that there are not too many volunteers to interfere there forcibly. I hope, incidentally, that we pass within a couple of days a resolution on this problem of migrants in the Mediterranean, which will provide additional legal basis for those who are trying to cope with that problem to do that. So, again, another example of the Security Council trying to contribute to resolving overall issues.
When you look at what's happening in Libya, do you ever think back and think we should have vetoed that?
You know, I believe under those circumstances our vote was correct. And the resolution was a good resolution. The problem was not that it was a bad resolution. The problem was that it was not implemented properly. And of course, when we were looking at that resolution, we did feel that it could be abused, that its sort of terms could be extended. So I made it very clear in my statement at the adoption of that resolution that we were following that, and we warned that it should not be happening. But our Western colleagues chose to, instead of protecting civilians, to conduct a major bombing campaign using that resolution as a pretext. I think they made a very bad mistake because it was bad for Libya, but also bad for as a precedent for the Security Council. They undercut trust in the Security Council. And one of the reasons why we were not able to produce resolutions on the settlement of the situation in Syria is that we simply were not trusting that they were going to do what they would be supposed to do under those resolutions which were proposed. So it was a very bad mistake, but the resolution, I think, under those circumstances was appropriate. You will recall that the first paragraph of that resolution was a call for immediate cessation of hostilities. And under that resolution, the African Union undertook a mediation mission, which was discarded quite rudely by our Western colleagues in the Security Council. It was high-level African Union mission. And when the resolution was adopted, they promised to the African members of the Security Council that it was not going to be regime change operation. But when that African Union mediation started, they said that the only way they're going to accept that was that it would involve the departure of Muammar Gaddafi. So it was really a kind of a dirty episode in the history of the Security Council when promises were made and broken, and when resolutions were written and then simply transgressed in a major way.
What would the world look like without Russia having veto power at the UN Security Council?
I don't know how much the world will change, but let me tell you, the Security Council will lose its relevance, and I'll explain why. It so happens the political structure of the world is such that the United States and its allies almost always have 9 votes to adopt a resolution, and they almost always have 7 votes to abstain and block a resolution, for instance, which we would be proposing without a veto. So if we didn't have a veto, then Security Council of the United Nations would simply be rubber stamping decisions which would be made in Washington, Paris, London, Brussels, in Western capitals. So it would lose its relevance, and it would not allow the Security Council to do the very important work of bringing about consensus decisions. So it's not just protecting the national interests or some other interests of the Russian Federation, but it's also protecting the integrity of the Security Council as a body which is supposed to represent the international community.
I would assume that Syria will now take center stage over the next couple of weeks over Ukraine. Certainly between the diplomats of the world. What's your assessment of the Ukraine situation at the moment?
Well, first of all, I think we're all very pleased that the fighting has subsided, apparently. There are some breaches of the ceasefire by Ukrainian forces, according to media reports, but it's considerably quieter than this used to be just a few weeks ago. And secondly, it is announced, as you know, that on the 2nd of October, the Normandy format meeting of the presidents is going to take place in Paris with the presidents of Russia, Chancellor of Germany, President of France, and President of Ukraine. So, of course, the hopes are widespread here in the United Nations that it will produce results which would really bring the implementation of the Minsk agreements much closer and will allow to look for a speedy conclusion of the crisis in Ukraine. But we'll see. You never know, because obviously in Kyiv there are various forces who are not necessarily looking for a speedy resolution of that conflict.
We see a lot of hot exchanges at the Security Council. I mentioned that. What kind of backdoor diplomacy happens? I mean, do you, behind the scenes, have lunch with Samantha Powers and kind of chat about what's happening in the world, or is it all very official and kind of what you see is what you get?
We do.
So it's not all that bad?
It's not all that bad. We talk on the phone all the time. We meet informally. We discuss things. I recall a situation where we, you know, as you put it, chatted about the problems of the world for 4 hours, you know, at the time. So, you know, we discuss things in a rather in-depth way, and on a working level, we have a good, solid professional relationship.
There's so much hype about the Russian president coming to New York. Obviously, he hasn't been at the UN General Assembly for 10 years or so. What kind of work would you, as the ambassador, like to see get done this week? And is it possible to get work done when there's so much hype?
In fact, my work is pretty routine now. I have the advance party, which is usually coming to town before the president arrives. So there are numerous technical details about arranging his visit. And of course, I have to try to complete our agenda of our presidency. So there is a combination, of things. And of course, we are trying to make sure that the visit of President Putin goes smoothly.
Meanwhile, while Ambassador Power rails against Russia's defense of Syria at the UN, here in the U.S., black families continue to be crushed by prison and early death, as Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford reports.
The Brookings Institution, an establishment think tank in Washington, D.C., commissioned a team of researchers to answer the question, is there a shortage of marriageable men in the United States? Black women have long claimed that there is a shortage of potential black husbands. The Brookings study shows that they were right. It is indeed more difficult for black women to find a black mate of roughly the same age, income, and education level. No such shortage exists among white Americans, except, ironically, among the most highly educated. Women of all races are better educated than their mothers and earn more money. However, male earnings, on average, have been stagnant or falling, especially for less skilled workers. For highly educated white women, finding a husband of comparable status has indeed become more difficult. The masses of black women face a mating problem of a whole different order. Mass black incarceration and inner-city violence have taken a devastating toll on the pool of potential husbands. According to the Brookings report, among black male high school dropouts, 60% will be dead or incarcerated before the age of 35. These black men won't be marrying or moving in with anybody, or paying child support, or acting as role models or protectors for their girlfriends' children. 72% of black births occur outside of marriage, compared to 29% of white births. But lots of couples form meaningful relationships without getting married. In a majority of out-of-marriage births, the two parents nevertheless live in the same home. 68% of white and Hispanic mothers who give birth out of wedlock are cohabiting with the fathers of their babies. However, only about 35% of the black women who give birth outside of marriage are cohabiting with the baby's father. The lesson of the statistics is unmistakable. Not only are black mothers much less likely to be married, but they are also much less likely to live with the fathers of their children. A 2011 Pew Research study showed that black fathers who don't live with their children nevertheless spend much more time with the kids than their white counterparts do, which demolishes the myth that black men don't care about their kids. But the stark fact remains that black men and women have been less successful than whites and Hispanics at living in the same household, whether they're married or not. The cause lies in the economic chaos and insecurity that this racist system has imposed on black people since emancipation, an historical crime that gets worse by the day under a capitalist system that no longer needs black labor. Black people are not supermen and superwomen. They cannot create economically viable households with only 1/20th of the wealth that white households possess, and they can't build families when they are dead or in prison. This is not about morality. It's about power and upending a power structure that has created a hostile environment for black life and for black families. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.